the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. LA's economy is opening up, but the coronavirus transmission rate is also up. We'll hear from Supervisor Catherine Barger if the county is still on track. Plus, we begin our series on the top three ways to reform the LAPD. We'll hear about what's worked in the past and what hasn't, and how history informs what people are feeling today. It's all ahead when Take 2 kicks off in just a few. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take 2. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up on the show, we'll have the first of what we hope will be many conversations about police reform, looking specifically at the Los Angeles Police Department. A lot of work has been done over the years to build a better force, one that is more community-focused, but as we've heard from protesters, more needs to be done. We'll hear from suggestions from Errol Southers, director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC. Plus, the long-running show Cops has been canceled, and HBO Max is pulling the Civil War epic Gone with the Wind from its rotation for the time being. We'll talk about that and all the latest from Hollywood in about 40 minutes. First, though, we're going to turn to L.A. County Supervisor Catherine Barger. There is a lot to discuss. L.A. and cities all over have been the site of countless protests calling for a change in how law enforcement conducts itself and how it should be funded, forcing lawmakers to consider deeper reforms. All this while the county continues to relax stay-at-home orders, with more businesses and services being allowed to open up, even as the number of COVID-19 cases ticks upward. Supervisor Catherine Barger, welcome back to the show.
How are you?
Good. How are you? This is a perfect time to have you on, actually. So let's start with this. Very specific to the city of Los Angeles. LAPD
county,
issued...
County.
I know you're the county supervisor.
Oh, I thought you meant literally. Okay.
No. I'm aware of your job title, supervisor. Now, specific to the city of LA, the LAPD issued a release earlier today saying that it is investigating 56 complaints about officer conduct during the unrest of 2 weekends ago, with 28 of those involving alleged uses of force. What's your reaction to hearing that?
Well, first of all, I think my reaction is that they should be investigated. There is no question that if there's misconduct taking place, whether it be a protester or law enforcement, accountability is important. And I tell people law enforcement actually is held to a higher standard, and the expectations are that they're trained to understand right from wrong. And so the fact that LA City and the chief are investigated, that's the way it's supposed to play out. And I think that's what the commission's purpose is, the police commission, is to ensure that there's transparency and that these things are investigated.
Now, we've got calls into the sheriff's department about this, but are you aware of any complaints it received and how it might be responding to them?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and I only know what I've seen on social media and what I know the sheriff has mentioned. There's been a few cases that are being investigated, but we have our a commission also that is about transparency that looks into these type of cases, and so I don't know exactly what the number is. I do know I'm familiar with one or two, and I promise you, just like LAPD is saying that they'll investigate those cases, we will investigate ours as well.
Now, on Monday, you said in response to a question about law enforcement response, so you said, quote, "I feel that they have done an incredible job, not only the sheriff, but LAPD." And you also added that we can always do better. Wondering, do you stand by that remark that they've done an incredible job?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I say this and I say it in a very, not a sarcastic, but sincere. In every sector, we can all do a better job. And law enforcement, given how quickly it escalated and then the looting started, I take my hat off to the men and women that were on the front line. So was it perfect? Absolutely not. And I think it highlights exactly what needs to be done within law enforcement. It's about training. It's about preparation. It's about better understanding situations that are coming to play. So, you know, I'm not going to make apologies for those that had any misconduct, but at the same time, I want to praise the men and women that put on the badge every day and represent to keep our community safe.
Sure, they put their lives on the line, but can you understand why a shop owner who hears you say that might think, well, wait a second, a shop owner that's lost everything and might not be able to put their store back on, you know, back online might be thinking, well, wait a second, that doesn't feel like an incredible job to me.
And so what I said is, not perfect. And I would agree. I was equally as outraged. First of all, what I saw happening, when I saw that looting take place, I knew those people were not down there to protest. They were using the protesters to distract so that they could go in and do what they were doing. And those were people from all walks of life going in and doing the looting. So, you know, I'm equally as outraged about that. But on a day-to-day basis, especially once the looting died down, which it did toward the end, and we were able to lift the curfews, law enforcement maintained peaceful protests and allowed the protesters to protest without a lot of issues taking place.
In what way, Supervisor, can law enforcement in LA County do better?
Well, you know, when I was a staff person for the prior supervisor, one of the things that I worked on was a team called the Mental Evaluation Team, because we recognized, especially with domestic violence, that when the law enforcement went out there, they were not equipped to understand how to de-escalate. So we paired mental health social workers with law enforcement that was also trained with social with mental health and social work background. We found that contact with individuals de-escalated the situation. 96% of those were not arrested. And in fact, they went about their lives, but they were able to de-escalate it, because we recognize that law enforcement really is not equipped to deal with a lot of what is going on. So when I first got elected, I pushed to increase the mental evaluation teams, but it's obvious to me that we need to do more in the community to support law enforcement, because law enforcement is being expected to do, I think, far more than what they're trained to do. So we need to invest in training, but we also need to invest in services that are going to complement what law enforcement is doing out in the field each and every day.
And that's what the city of Los Angeles at least is proposing, with Mayor Eric Garcetti moving money from the LAPD to certain community services. Is that something you would support for the county, to move some money away from the Sheriff's Department into these kinds of services?
Why does it have to be an either or? I think that's part of the problem. If you look at the ratio of officer to population here, and you hear how many cars are covering, you know, square miles, I would argue it should not be an either or, it should be an and. And we need to, we as government need to prioritize how we're spending our money to make sure that we are working together versus expecting, in this case, law enforcement to do some of the things that, quite frankly, should be done by social service agencies. And investing in community-based programs, you know, when we look at what we're doing with it, reducing the jail population and working on moving incarcerated youth back into the community, it's all about pairing up with community-based organizations to make sure that they don't end up back in camps or end up in jail. In addition to that, even before they end up in our camps or end up in our jails, investing in the community in programs that will provide a good foundation so that they don't go down the wrong path. So I don't see it as an either-or, and I'm very firm on that. I believe that we need to work together, and that law enforcement should be a partner with these community-based programs to make sure that we are providing, you know, public safety for the community, but also services for that community as well.
I guess finding the money then, I guess, would be the question, because in a time right now where the county, the state, everyone is just strapped for cash, finding that money to not cut police and yet still find money for those community services, I think, is the big question.
Well, in good times, we were able to find money to do a lot of things that, quite frankly, were not mandates. So I think, again, it comes back down to prioritizing. And when you listen to what people are saying out on the street, this is not just about law enforcement. This is about society as a whole, about the fact that we all need to take a step back and check ourselves and find out why this has gone on for so long. And it took an individual being murdered in Minneapolis to really drive this discussion. You know, I'm not going to react to defunding based on one situation. I believe that we as a whole need to take a step back and start to reprioritize and recognize that maybe we need to look at how we are spending our resources. And, you know, you can't fund everything, but at the same time, we've heard loud and clear from the public what the needs are. Now we need to figure out how to do it without taking money from law enforcement.
Now, on that, police reform, obviously the top of a lot of lawmakers' agenda right now, including the Board of Supervisors. You all voted yesterday to support a statewide ban on a controversial neck hold used by police. And this follows Alex Villanueva, the sheriff, on Monday, who said deputies can only use that restraint method if the suspect's actions, quote, rise to the level of deadly force. So, Supervisor, what does the Board of Supervisors vote be in principle then?
Well, actually, the board continued that item, but I know that Sheriff Villanueva has sent out a list that shows that, in fact, the criteria that the board was going to vote on yesterday, it was a vote motion by Supervisor Ridley Thomas and Janice Hahn. That motion would have included the eight points that they want to address police reform. And that was not voted on, but I know that Alex has said that, in fact, all eight of those issues, or the neck hold especially, the choke hold, are no longer being used.
Talking to LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger. All right, now let's move to reopening, because LA County announced gyms, day camps, museums, zoos, campgrounds, hotels for leisure travel can open on Friday. Supervisor, what went into that decision?
Well, public health. That's what went into that decision. When you look at what the county has done, the county has kept positive test rates low. Right now, they're at approximately 5%, give or take. When we first applied for the variants, they were hovering at about 8%. Hospitalizations are still low, less than 13% of those being hospitalized with COVID, which at the peak was at 21%. Preventing healthcare system from being overwhelmed. We are in fact seeing a system that is not overwhelmed based on COVID. So we continue to meet that criteria, and the county is aligned with the state as it relates to public health guidance. So we're moving forward. I know there's a lot of people saying, well, the test numbers are going up a positive. Yeah. That's because we're doing more tests. We are actually getting out in the community, providing tests for individuals. What we look at is the positive test results, and those are staying at about 5%. The threshold for the state to allow us to get the variants was 8%, so we are still under that threshold.
One thing, nail salons are still not on the list to reopen yet. Why nail salons? Why aren't they on the list yet?
That is the state's guideline, and I have many people asking that question. I also, if you saw my nails, would know that I'm also wondering the same thing, but that is the state guideline, and I would have to ask the governor what his thoughts are on that. I know that barbershops and hair salons have been reopened, and I think, if I'm not incorrect, the nail industry is going to court asking for a decision on allowing them to open.
Thing is, okay, so I mentioned some of the things that are going to reopen or can reopen on Friday, but parties, gatherings, and mixing of households is still not allowed. Supervisor, I'm wondering, how is this not going to get confusing for people?
Well, I literally have to look at a list each day in terms of what the state is allowing us to open. So, for example, today we announced that day camps for child and youth, which start actually for June 12th, music, film, and TV production, fitness facilities, gyms, sports training facilities, hotels, even though they weren't closed, essential travel was. So hotels are now being allowed to reopen. Campgrounds, RV parks, outdoor recreation, and then museums, galleries, zoos, aquariums. Those are all slated for June 12th. This is a work in progress, and it's a slow opening. And I think that if people look at our public health website at lacounty.gov, and you can look at that, we're trying to be as clear as possible in terms of what can reopen. I know it's complicated. It seems so much easier to shut everything down. But as we open them up, we're doing it in a very deliberate, slow fashion, because when you look at how we prevented the spread, we want to maintain that. And with the protests and all, there is a concern that the numbers may spike. I'm hoping for the best, but preparing for the fact that we may need to rethink, you know, how quickly we reopen on other sectors moving forward.
Yeah, because I'm thinking to myself, I mean, I kind of share your opinion on certain things when it comes to certain things that I'd like to see open. I can't wait to go to the gym again. But if I'm going to the gym, I find it kind of hard to believe that I can't go visit my friends in other places that they live. It just seems like one shouldn't be mixed with the other. It's either all or nothing in a way in these kind of situations.
No, and you know, it's interesting because even Dr. Ferrer has said that. We've talked about this because there are inconsistencies. I mean, why on one hand can you go into a casino, which is allowed to be open, but not card shops, card rooms are not on that list. So there are inconsistencies, and we agree with that. That's one of the reasons why I pushed so hard to become aligned with the state and with their public health guidance, because I felt there were interpretations that the county was taking into play that were not consistent with what the state was requiring. And I'm hoping that as we do that, we can really flush out some of the inconsistencies and get everything back on track. Because to your point, there were those that said, well, a pool is a pool, so why can an HOA open their pool, but the pool down the street that's, you know, for the neighborhood is not allowed to? No. They both have chlorine in them. Good question. And now we finally are able to push that and move that forward.
That's LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger. Supervisor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to begin our series on the top three ways to reform the LAPD. We'll hear about what's worked in the past and what hasn't, and how history informs what people are feeling today. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. After the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white officer in Minnesota and the ensuing unrest across the country, there have been countless calls for police reform. This is a place we've been before in Los Angeles, and change has happened over the years, but as the many protests have shown us, it's clearly not been enough. So, what now? Starting today, we'll be having a series of conversations about reform and how the LAPD and other law enforcement agencies can build trust within the community. To start us off, we have Errol Suthers, director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC, where he's also a professor of national and homeland security.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get to what more needs to be done, let's look at the work that has been going on. And you helped develop community policing training program for the LAPD. How does the program work, Errol, and how long has that been going on?
Well, we helped to develop the LEAD program, Law Enforcement Advanced Development Program. That program was based on the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing document that came out in 2015 in the last administration. And the program was designed to address a number of the items that were identified in that study. Most importantly, building trust and legitimacy with the community, community policing and crime reduction, and of course, officer wellness and safety. That program carried on for three cohorts. Unfortunately, it's on a pause right now. We're trying to restructure it quite a bit. But the key component of that program was a capstone project that was actually identified by the communities that the officers served in terms of the top priority problem in that neighborhood. And then they work with the community to put a solution together, presented it to LAPD command staff, and then tried to operationalize it in the future months that came along.
Errol, on a fundamental level, on a basic level, what establishes that trust? Is it the fact that you're going to the community first and having these conversations with them before it moves up the chain? Is that how fundamentally the trust starts to build?
That's exactly how it starts. And I was really disappointed when community-oriented policing first started. I was a part of that when I was in the police department. And unfortunately, community-oriented policing meant that the police went out and said to the community, "Hi, we're here to help you. Now we're going to tell you what we're going to do." And they never really asked for input. They never had any roundtable discussions or conversations about, look, here's what our priorities are. Sometimes the police would interpret the top problem as a gang problem when someone in the community would say, as has happened in reality, you know, we need better lighting in the alleyway, or we need crosswalk markers at the crosswalks. And those are the things that we can do right away. And so by doing that, the community was then bought in. The officers were obviously bought in, and they felt like they were all producing a solution that was viable. The other thing that was always a problem and led to unrest the last time we had it was that the department didn't reflect the demographics of the communities they were serving. So many of those Asian, Hispanic, African-American officers are now coming to the department because they've been involved in programs as students in their schools and kids, and they have now seen the police as not being the enemy, and being a very viable and lucrative career that they can actually give back to the community as they grew up in.
Now, Errol, but by the look and sound of the protest, this, quote, good work has not made a dent in the perception of the police by many in the community. Why not? Why hasn't this worked?
Well, because unfortunately, the cry of more training, more training, more training has not stemmed the tide of incidents of abuse and excessive force. I have narrowed it down to, this is not a training problem. This is a culture problem. unfortunately, we have officers that go into the training, implicit bias, de-escalation of force, community building, consensus building, check the box and go into the field and do the same things they did yesterday. And so we have a culture that has to be adjusted, not just the training that has to be addressed or delivered, but a culture that has to be adjusted.
Talking to Errol Southers, director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC, where he's also a professor of national and homeland security. All right, Errol, so let's get to what more needs to be done, because for this series, we're asking everyone to come up with their top three recommendations on how to reform the LAPD. So let's start with your first one, which is don't reinvent the wheel and reinvest in a program that lost funding. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. The LEAD program was fundamental. The officers loved it. The community loved it. The command staff attended the capstone presentations that we had, Chief Moore, all of his assistant deputy chiefs and commanders. There's no need to reinvent the wheel. The 21st Century Policing Initiative document works. We have operationalized it. And I was really disappointed that we lost funding and it couldn't continue. And I think since we've already tried it and it's functional, let's go back and use it again.
Why did it wind up losing funding?
Honestly, it was a grant by several donors, and the grant had a timeline. In the midst of trying to continue it, we were seeking more grant funding, and we were simply unsuccessful.
But when it comes to something like that, if a lot of people think it worked, wouldn't it be worked into a budget where it wouldn't need to survive with grant funding?
I absolutely agree and concur. And unfortunately, we were not part of the ongoing budget for LAPD with some other priorities that they had. And we were one of those programs that wasn't able to be sustained.
Now, your next recommendation comes from your background in Long Beach. What could the LAPD do that Long Beach does already?
I was the director of the Citizen Police Complaint Commission. And one of the things that I think LAPD could do, although they have a police commission, is in Long Beach, they have an independent civilian oversight board that looked at all allegations of police misconduct. They had subpoena power, they had the power to investigate, and we did. They had a representative from each of these 15 council districts. We went through every case that the officers were involved in, and then although the findings didn't alter the outcome and recommendations of internal affairs, those findings were taken into consideration as Internal Affairs was trying to adjudicate each case of misconduct.
Why would a citizen commission be important when LAPD already has a commission of its own? What would make that something that could be more effective, at least in public perception?
This citizen commission would be specifically focused on officer misconduct. This would not be a commission that addresses equipment, personnel, policies. And we're having this conversation today because of police misconduct. And I think we need to prioritize the problem. And to me, that's the number one problem.
All right. Now, Errol, your last recommendation isn't specific to LAPD, but something that could help all departments as they hire and train officers. So what do you suggest?
Well, I'm suggesting an element of transparency. I signed on to a letter by an organization that I work with called LEAP. It's Law Enforcement Action Partnership. We're over 80 retired law enforcement professionals in the country. We sent recommendations to transform policing to Congress and to local and state jurisdictions. And this transparency element is a recommendation for an independent national database. All officers who are terminated or resigned due to misconduct, and that misconduct would include but not be limited to things like excessive force, domestic violence, assault, they should be in that database and prohibited by law from being certified as a police officer ever again in any state. This, I think, would be very useful if we're going to reestablish trust and legitimacy in the community. We've got to have an easier way to get rid of those officers that shouldn't be there.
And when it comes to those complaints on someone's record, if someone, say, were to resign from the LAPD and go, say, to the Sheriff's Department, how much would people know of that person's record just moving around?
It all depends. I mean, if they go to another state, that state may know nothing. If they go to another department and they resigned, and it's written up as they resigned because they didn't meet the standards of the department, or they resigned because they weren't interested anymore, that's all you would know. And I'm not an expert on how each department is able to share that kind of information with a future department, but a resignation usually clears them up to go to another department with almost a clean slate and start over again.
You know, Errol, you mentioned earlier about this being a culture problem, an issue of culture in the police department. How do these recommendations? How does something like this stick to where, say, 5 years from now, Errol, we're not having these same kinds of conversations?
Well, the first thing that has to happen is it starts at the top. And one of the things we didn't include in those three recommendations, we need to first educate mayors who select chiefs so that they select the right chief. Let's go back to Minneapolis and how we got here today. Minneapolis should have been the poster child for reform. They had an openly gay and indigenous female chief who I know. They had a review from DOJ under the Obama administration. And then after that, there was a settlement in Minneapolis to receive training that include not placing detainees in the prone position as they did with Mr. Floyd. Last but not least, right now, they currently have a black chief. With all that in place, it's still not working. So I think that one of the things we have to do to address this culture is to make sure that we've got a chief that's picking the right person. And then let's start at the bottom. That training and those officers that are selected need to be the right officers. And I have to say this, there should be an easier way to either discipline them and or terminate them if they're not living up to the standards and mission of the department.
Errol, let's end by talking about the conversation that LA City Council will be having all month long, and that's about LAPD's budget. What concerns do you have about taking money away from the LAPD?
Look, I've been an assistant chief. I understand budgets very well. And if I have to look at a reduction in my budget, the first thing I'm going to make sure that I don't reduce are my personnel and their equipment. Those things that might not be as essential are the things that we've talked about earlier, like the Police Activities League, the Cadet Program, the Explorer Programs. Those programs that are putting us in the community now are going to be the programs that I'm going to have to reduce. The long-term cascading effect of that is we now have less contact with those communities that we want officers to come from in the future, and our recruiting capacity and hiring capacity from those neighborhoods is now reduced because we're not out there interacting with those kids when they can become more interested in becoming police officers. Unfortunately, reducing the funding does not reduce the problem officers.
Errol, are you confident that there are ways that the LAPD can reform and then do it in a way that satisfies the public, even if its budget gets untouched?
I'm confident if that conversation with the community is where they sit at the table as equal partners and actually do it. We can't have a situation where the department is left with, here's what we're going to do. I think we really need to have everybody at the table with an equal stake to have a conversation about how it's going to be done, how we're going to measure its effectiveness, and how we're going to determine whether or not it's being successful, and if not, how we're going to fix it. One thing I have to say, regardless of how good or not so good departments are, they should not be left to police themselves. And that's one of the reasons I'm a strong advocate for some oversight. And I'm a strong advocate for putting people at the table at the onset to determine, look, here's what we have. Here's what we should do. How are we going to do this together? The trust that we're looking for is a function of respect. We need to respect the input of the community, take that into consideration, and work together at a viable solution.
Errol Southers, director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC, where he's also a professor of national and homeland security. Errol, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Gil Scott-Heron once said, "The revolution will not be televised." Well, it is 2020, and today it's not only televised, but also it's live streamed and posted. But as I said, it is 2020, and while social media can be a great source of information and facts, it's also a very formidable and sometimes hard to separate fact from fiction source of misinformation. From the pandemic to the protests, how social media has helped inform and also misinform the public. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Tell me how can a color determine whether you're wrong or right? We
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and also on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Social media has played a critical role in the protests that came about after the death of George Floyd. It's been used to share the video of his final moments and images of the resulting protests. But as useful as social media has been for the sharing of ideas and information, it's also helped give rise to misinformation. Think false narratives, photoshopped images, and fake activist accounts. With so much at stake during this time, we wanted to take a deeper look at what's happening online. Joan Donovan is the research director for the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, social media has played a large role in the protests we've seen over the past few weeks. It's been a rallying point for people on all sides of the issues. It's even been used to organize protests and spread news about what's happening on the streets. But a lot of the narratives that have gotten traction have later been debunked. Joan, I'm looking at the way information has been shared and even distorted online. What are some of the false narratives that have gained a lot of traction that you've noticed?
There have been some horrible false narratives that we've seen circulating related to George Floyd himself, very similar to the Sandy Hook narratives around this being a situation where there were crisis actors and that George Floyd actually isn't dead. These kinds of things do persist on social media because they allow for intrigue. They're easy to share. They promote people to do their own kind of research. So that has been a particularly difficult one to dispel. And then the second one, of course, is things that we're seeing the president tweet about related to Antifa, perhaps living within different towns and being bussed into different cities and plane loads. And then we saw yesterday the allegation that the man in Buffalo that had been severely injured by police potentially had been part of Antifa. And this outside agitator narrative, I should say, is very common among state agencies every time we have a mass protest like we do now.
And I understand what you mean, Joan. Yeah, false narratives, I think, are fuel for a lot of people that want to buy into them. But I got to think, a rational person, Joan, someone with any shred of common sense would steer away from these things? Or am I just being too idealistic?
You never know really what's going to take hold in the minds of people who are afraid, who are seeking leadership. In some ways, you can, just like you can look at the protest, you can look at the signs of the protesters and know very clearly what their demands are. You can also look at these counter events around armed militias showing up or even people patrolling their own neighborhoods. You've got these roving white vigilante groups now in different areas waiting for the parade of Antifa in order to kick it off. And to me, it's really scary. And from my point of view, the narrative's coming from somewhere that they trust. And we're seeing these narratives circulate, particularly within right-wing media ecosystems. And that's a serious problem because it's not just that they see it once and they think, oh, that's possible. They see it over and over and over again through all of the different forms of social media that they take in. And then if they turn on right-wing cable news.
You've done a lot of research on something called source hacking. That's when bad actors target journalists and other influential public figures to pick up falsehoods so they unknowingly amplify them to the public. Do you see more source hacking when there are hot button issues in the news cycle, such as race?
Oh, definitely. And one of the ways that happens is through what we call the butterfly attack, which is basically that you'll have groups of people or even just an individual register a bunch of accounts that look like other social justice movements. So we've seen it happen where white supremacists organized and created a bunch of accounts where they looked like Black feminists on Twitter. The Antifa accounts that are on Twitter, some of them have been run by white supremacists. And even recently, Twitter came out and said, yeah, we shut down this one account that was making calls to violence. And they're tied to these other accounts that we know were run by white supremacists. And so this butterfly attack is really about mimicking the patterns of behavior of your opponent so that you can kind of own the issue on both sides. And that way in which you can represent a reality online that doesn't really exist is at the root of why we study misinformation, because we do want people in their authenticity to come through, especially as the internet and social media has come to play an incredibly important role in our political system.
Talking to Joan Donovan, Research Director for the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Joan, who are the people who are pushing false narratives? Give us a profile of who these people are.
On some level, some people are just chaos agents. They are only interested in disruption. And that's where we get a lot of trolls who do network harassment, specifically trying to get journalists to shut their accounts down or stop covering certain areas. But I think one thing that we tilt towards is trying to blame some kind of foreign other, saying, oh, there's Russia, there's China, Saudi Arabia, different state actors are blanketing the social media territory with misinformation. But by and large, there are just as many domestic actors at play. But what's difficult from studying it from the outside is that platform companies, of course, are the only group that have the right information, that have enough information to make some solid determination about the culprits. But our research tends to try to look in other places and try to find the roots of different disinformation campaigns. And unfortunately, when we do find them, there's really no sanction. There's no rule book around what does it mean to pretend to be 100 fake Antifa accounts online, even if they're calling for violence.
I'm wondering if maybe you could walk me through how a false narrative goes viral. Is there maybe an example from the George Floyd protests that you can point to?
Yeah, I'll give you a sort of a routine case that's a pattern you can see in quite a few different cases. There's an anonymous message board online where someone puts a call to action where, wouldn't it be funny if we got people to shave their heads for Black Lives Matter? So they start using the hashtag #GoBaldForBLM or #BaldForBLM. They'll go over to other spaces online, maybe Instagram or Flickr. They'll grab some pictures of people shaving their heads. And they'll make it seem as if there is some kind of movement behind this. And they'll add in different commentary. They'll tweet it out. They'll say, I'm going bald for BLM. Mm. They've registered some newly fake accounts. And they're trying to seed this idea that this act of solidarity is a way in which you can participate in the protests from home. And so we saw that happening over the weekend. But with a lot of these disinformation campaigns, they either happen or they fizzle out. When they happen, it's usually when a celebrity or a journalist or someone else that doesn't know that it's an imposter picks it up and says, look at what these people are doing. Sometimes they'll say, oh, this is so outrageous. Look at what they're doing. They're shaving their heads for Black Lives Matter. And so we've seen that happen literally hundreds of times. Wow. At this point.
You know, Joan, I'm wondering, I know Twitter sparked controversy last month when they fact-checked a tweet by President Trump about voting by mail. And then he later tweeted the words, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Twitter tagged that post as well, saying it could incite violence. All the while, Facebook opted to remain silent. Does the responsibility of the tech companies get a lot more complicated when it's the president of the United States who is the one spreading misinformation?
I think you're right in the sense that it does change the dynamics of the situation when it is a world leader or an elected official, because there is a desire for people to want to be able to find that information. But there's no reason why these platform companies can't create a human rights locker or human rights archive where they do remove these things that are incitements to violence and put it somewhere else that people can access and they can read more about the context in which that particular message or post got flagged.
Joan, the election is just 5 months away, and I don't imagine that there are going to be significant changes to social media policy before then. And it's clear race will likely be a major issue heading into November. What should we be bracing ourselves for leading up to November?
Yeah, me and my team have been mulling this over quite a bit. We do need a robust program for mail-in ballots, because the pandemic isn't going anywhere. We don't get out of this without a treatment and vaccines. So until such time, which is probably not going to be enough time before November, we do need a plan for democracy. if we're going to have an election, which I do believe we will, we don't want it to turn into political pandemonium.
Will it amp up, you think, on social media, though, all of this misinformation?
Oh, yeah, because any adjustment, and we see this back to the Iowa caucus as a kind of testing ground, any adjustment to the voting process is going to lead to allegations of disinformation, bad actors. And so we have to be really careful about election integrity, and we have to be very careful about how we talk about the adjustments to the voting process so that people are completely informed about where they get their ballot, about how they make their vote, and about how those are going to be tallied and counted. As the election draws closer, we're going to have to look to many of our civil society groups that do election integrity work for their eyes and ears, because those are going to be the watchdogs that are going to ensure that we get a free and fair election.
Joan Donovan is the research director for the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Joan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, you just heard about how social media can be great for information, but sometimes also a really bad place for misinformation. That is not what you get at KPCC. Researched, verified, credible facts and information. Please, if that is important to you, as I know it is, please support us. KPCC.org. That's KPCC.org. All right, Hollywood is still on hold, but so close now to opening up and firing up the cameras. When they do, we'll hear how the entertainment biz will respond to what many Americans are feeling these days. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Hollywood is in week two of following the George Floyd protests. Plus, after more than 30 years on the air, Cops is canceled. Time now to go on the lot with Rebecca Keegan. She's with The Hollywood Reporter, and she joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Welcome back, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, now we've entered week two of the protests. What have you noticed about what's different in Hollywood's response during this second week? How does it differ from last week?
Well, in the first week, companies were issuing statements. They were giving donations to groups that focus on racial justice issues. As we've entered week two, we were starting to see the industry look inward. People are looking at their own companies' hiring practices. They're looking at the content they create, and they're asking, you know, who's missing from this room, this writer's room, this executive suite, and what are we putting out in the world that's shaping the culture that got us to George Floyd's killing?
So we're seeing a lot more political engagement in all corners of Hollywood. What are some specific examples that you can highlight?
Well, a few things that have happened in the last week, multiple agencies, the big four, ICM, CAA, WME, UTA, participated in a Black Lives Matter march organized by ICM. It was about 2,000 people who walked from the ICM headquarters in Century City to the Beverly Hills Police Department. Michael B. Jordan spoke, as did a leader of the LA Black Lives Movement. There have also been some kind of unusually candid corporate town halls where Black employees have expressed frustration. In this week's issue of The Hollywood Reporter, I wrote about the Warner Media town hall where the company's new CEO, Jason Kilar, who's white, talked about racism not just in society, but in his own company. That's a level of candor from a white executive in Hollywood that is something new to me.
Now, meanwhile, white showrunners like Warren Leight are taking a step back and questioning depictions on some of the shows they run. Tell us more about the responsibility some of these showrunners are trying to take.
Right. My colleagues at The Hollywood Reporter interviewed Warren Leight, who's the showrunner of Law & Order SVU, and he talked about in his genre, the sort of police procedural genre, historically it's been white male showrunners hiring other white male writers, and that their experience of policing largely shapes the narratives that are told. Because those jobs have not been going to a diverse group of people historically, then when showrunners say, hey, I need writers with experience on a police procedural, they're drawing from a very homogenous group. Light said he'd made an effort to diversify his writing staff recently, but he felt like that effort was not enough.
All right, now let's zero in on an initiative from filmmaker Ava DuVernay, who we should say was elected to the board of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences today, and her endeavor is called the Law Enforcement Accountability Project, or LEAP. How did this new thing come about?
Well, interestingly, because of the work she's done as a director, Ava DuVernay has a lot of experience looking at videos of trauma and violence, particularly against Black people. And she told me that she was struck by how much she was impacted by the George Floyd video, and she called it a quote-unquote casual lynching. What she was struck by was the visual of the officer and the casualness of his sort of bearing. And that sparked in her the sense that we really don't know a lot about the officers involved in these cases. She decided to create a fund to finance 25 projects in film, art, music, other disciplines that deal with this issue of police violence.
So it sounds like using art to hold law enforcement accountable.
Right. I mean, I think DuVernay's feeling is if you show audiences who these officers are via art, it will increase awareness and potentially change behaviors.
Talking to Rebecca Keegan of The Hollywood Reporter. Now, among other changes in Hollywood brought about through the protests and the Black Lives Matter movement is the removal of this reality TV staple. Yeah, after being on the air for 30 years, three decades, Paramount Network has pulled the show Cops indefinitely. Not exactly a surprising move, though, right, Rebecca? I mean, the show has really been deemed problematic long before now. What are some of the criticisms that show has faced over the years?
Well, a consistent criticism of the show has been that it typically makes heroes of white, predominantly white cops who are busting predominantly Black people. Often with force, sometimes with stun guns. Because the viewer is riding along with the cops, you're sort of inherently invited to take their position, their viewpoint. There have also been some criticisms that producers for the show pressure some of the people featured on it into signing release forms. If you've ever watched Cops and wondered why on earth would people agree to let themselves be shown on TV in this context, people have said that, in fact, it was unclear sometimes whether it was the police telling them to sign something or a reality TV producer telling them to sign something.
Wow. Okay, so in that vein, I want to play some tape from our sister show, The Frame. They spoke to one of the show's creators, John Langley, 4 years ago, and here he is addressing accusations of perpetuating stereotypes.
It's no secret that the majority of crime takes place in disenfranchised areas and ghettos. That's just a fact and always has been a fact. Look, it's an economic issue, among other things, not just a cultural issue. You're going to see people, the have-nots are going to commit more crimes than the haves. That's just a fact, no matter where you are in the world. So we're not consciously seeking to stigmatize any group or any culture. We're only doing an observation of street crime.
Rebecca, with the cancellation of the show Cops, it seems like this defense of the show no longer holds water. What did Paramount say about canceling it, and was the stereotyping of criminals a part of it?
Well, Paramount, an interesting thing to note is that the show had a very small audience. You know, it's been around, as you say, for more than 30 years, but there were only about 400,000 people watching it. And it seems like Paramount really just made a business decision that the audience drawn by this show is not worth the controversy and the criticism that it's inspired.
And Hollywood is driven by business. We all know
that.
Yeah. Okay. So meanwhile, another Hollywood staple are being reconsidered now. Others. 1939 classic film Gone with the Wind has been removed from HBO Max, at least for now. What sparked this action?
Well, John Ridley, a Black screenwriter who wrote 12 Years a Slave, wrote an op-ed in the LA Times saying that Gone with the Wind glorifies the antebellum South, that it ignores the horrors of slavery and perpetuates stereotypes. And he called on HBO Max to take it off their service temporarily and put it in some context, surround it with other films that depict slavery more accurately or with some commentary that sort of frames where Gone with the Wind fits into American history.
And that's how it will come back on HBO Max when it it comes back with that context.
Right. HBO Max has said it's pulling the film temporarily and eventually will bring it back, quote, with a discussion of its historical context.
I mean, the film is considered an American classic, but I'm wondering, Rebecca, how big of a deal is it that HBO Max is handling it in this way?
I think it's significant. I mean, Gone with the Wind, unlike, say, Cops, is a crucial piece of cinema history and of American history. Hattie McDaniel became the first Black person to receive an Oscar for her role in the film as Scarlett O'Hara's maid, Mammy. And while the Oscar was a point of pride, the role that she played of a maid with really no inner life of her own shown on screen would be one that Black women in Hollywood were largely limited to for decades to come. So a point of pride, but also pain. And this is different than what Disney's done with its infamous movie Song of the South, which is to make it totally unavailable. You can still watch Gone with the Wind other places. It's just not being presented on HBO Max until the service can contextualize it.
It's one of those things, Rebecca, you can't tell the history of cinema without mentioning Gone with the Wind, right? It's that crucial to telling the history of movie making.
And you can't tell the history of movies without noticing the enormous racism and sexism and other isms that are part of our history.
Yeah. Now, one more thing. In keeping with the theme of this newfound engagement on behalf of Hollywood, I want to take a moment to talk about some other actions companies have taken. So let's start with Netflix. How have they joined in on the movement?
Netflix created kind of a Black Lives Matter playlist, highlighting original programming that deals with issues of racial injustice. So, like their show Dear White People, When They See Us, the Ava DuVernay series about the wrongfully accused five Black boys in the Central Park jogger case. There's the Michelle Obama documentary, and then stuff that isn't Netflix's own, like the movie Malcolm X, Moonlight, and She's Gotta Have It.
It really feels, Rebecca, like in this past week, Hollywood has come together to mobilize and unite against, unite with this cause. Is there a time to point out in history where something similar has happened that sparked true change?
You know, in the 15 years I've been covering Hollywood, I've not seen anything like the response of the last 10 days. You could look maybe at the civil rights movement, which many in Hollywood supported. But even then, many people, I think, were afraid to speak out. This feels very different.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every Wednesday. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap it up. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.